there are things we know increase survival. Early CPR, high quality CPR, continuous compressions limiting the time off of the chest, early defibrillation. These are the things that we know increase survival and cardiac arrest. Advanced airway management is just not on that list.
Here you on 8.
You on 8.
Okay, you're clear. Stand by for your base.
Welcome to EMS Cast, where we provide high-level education for you, the providers on the streets. I'm your host, Ross Orpit, a recovering paramedic turned ED doc, here again with our co-host, Will Berry, a practicing critical care paramedic.
Hey, everybody. My name is Will, like Ross said, and I live and work in North Carolina. And if you're new to the show, Ross and I actually used to work as paramedics together in Denver, Colorado. And we're happy if you're just now finding us. Thank you so much. And we're excited to jump into this next topic.
Yeah, we missed each other so much. We had to keep working together doing this for you guys. So today we're diving into a topic that hits close to home for every EMT, paramedic, and pre-hospital care provider out there. And that's the critical moments following an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And more specifically, what exactly are our most pressing priorities in these resuscitations?
Yeah, Ross, there's a lot of information out there about this specific topic and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And I think a lot of systems now are very structured in how they approach these calls. But to make what we're going to talk about relevant, or at least feel more relevant, perhaps, I wanted to present a case. So I responded, just me and another paramedic on an ambulance. We responded to a bus stop for chest pain. When we arrived at the bus stop, we were met with a male patient experiencing chest pain. We were the first ones there. No law enforcement, no fire department or other first responders. We started assessing our patient, and right then and there, he went into cardiac arrest. So, what should we do first? I think we know through BLS, ACLS, and the like that early chest compressions and early defibrillation matter, and we're going to talk about that. But I'm a paramedic. I have lots of tools at my disposal, and right now in this story, it's just me and my partner. So what should I do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, as paramedics, we have all these advanced tools and tricks that we want to try and hope that they're going to make a difference or move the needle at the end of the day. But as we might find, the basics might matter more than anything else. So starting immediate compressions, getting pads on and defibrillating as soon as possible might actually be the most important things. Each year, countless lives, as you just illustrated, hang in the balance as EMS teams across the globe respond to cardiac arrests outside the hospital. You know, survival from all comers in these scenarios are low, but the decisions made in these moments are crucial and might mean the difference between life and death and neurological recovery or impairment. During these resuscitations, multiple interventions are performed simultaneously and sequentially. One of the key decisions involves the use of epinephrine, and another is the timing of advanced airway management. So the 2020 AHA guidelines for cardiopulmonary resuscitation notes that it may be reasonable to administer epi actually after initial defibrillation attempts have failed for those patients who present with a shockable rhythm. Now, this is just a weak recommendation based on limited data, but contrast that with the recommendation given for those presenting with non-shockable rhythms, where they stated it is reasonable to administer epinephrine as soon as possible, giving this one a moderate recommendation, but still based on limited data. Now, they don't give much guidance on the timing of advanced airway management, noting that it requires consideration of a host of patient and healthcare professional characteristics. But the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation noted that there is a current knowledge gap with regards to the optimal timing during cardiopulmonary resuscitation that we should change from a bag mask ventilation to advanced airway management. So in an attempt to shed more light on this knowledge gap, Okubo et al. Performed a study that we're going to talk about today, published in JAMA Network Open earlier this year, entitled Sequence of Epinephrine and Advanced Airway Placement After Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. Whether you're a seasoned veteran or new to the field, understanding these findings could potentially change the way you approach cardiac arrest management. So let's dive into what they did in this study, what it tells us, what it doesn't answer, and finally, how it might influence our approach to resuscitating out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the future.
Yeah, Ross, I'm interested to dive into this because I haven't been in EMS as long as some, but I've been in long enough to see the pendulum swing from certain meds being prioritized first, airway being prioritized first, using your judgment, to all kinds of things in between. So I'm interested to hear more about this study.
Yeah, I mean, you and I may talk about this more at the end, but the cardiac arrest literature seems to be all over the place across the years. And we'll get into why that might be. But first, let's dive into this study and what they did. So this study was led by a team of researchers from Japan, and it was a retrospective cohort study analyzing the nationwide population-based out-of-hospital cardiac arrest registry in Japan. The researchers included adults aged 18 years and older who experienced an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and for whom EMS personnel administered epinephrine and or performed advanced airway management between January 1st, 2014 and December 31st, 2019.
So 5 years, that's a pretty large data set.
Yeah.
What seems to make it compelling is the scope of the data they analyzed. We're talking about, this is a significant number of cases. It's 259,237 patients that were eligible for the study. This data set gives a unique opportunity to really understand the sequence of the interventions and if that sequence matters for patient outcomes.
For sure. And that's really what they hope to show here. Like you said, that's a good chunk of patients, but it's important to understand the limitations of a retrospective analysis. So retrospective analysis often rely on data that just wasn't initially collected for research purposes. So determining the sequence of events can be problematic in a retrospective analysis, especially when the timing of exposure and outcome is not clearly defined or when records do not accurately reflect the temporal sequences. So unlike prospective randomized controlled trials, retrospective studies do not involve random assignment or to treatment or control groups. And this can introduce various biases related to treatment selection because it can be challenging to account for all potential confounding variables or factors that might influence why providers chose one intervention over the other in the first place. The absence of this randomization and failure to adequately control for all of these variables, known and unknown, can make it difficult to establish a causal relationship between the timing of the intervention and the outcome, as other factors might explain the effects that we're seeing. So these factors can compromise the reliability of the findings and may lead to incorrect conclusions being drawn from the data. But despite these limitations, retrospective analyses of registries do remain a powerful tool for understanding real-world outcomes, for generating hypotheses, and for identifying areas of future research.
A lot of what they're doing is most likely reading patient care reports for pre-hospital providers or looking at the available data of the calls that took place. And we both know some of those things can, well, you know, our documentation sometimes isn't the best pre-hospitally, especially when a lot of things are happening all at once or simultaneously.
Yeah.
But what I think I'm hearing you say too is a tool like this study can also be good in identifying what needs to be researched next.
Yeah, exactly. And refer back to our episode on why your documentation matters. If you want better research, document better. But you're exactly right. We all know that mistakes get entered. We're lazy at times. We don't enter data as accurately as we should. And so you can't really define a causal relationship based on these retrospective analyses, but they do try to control for some of this. So to mitigate some of these limitations, the researchers often employ like sophisticated statistical techniques and sensitivity analyses. And in this study, the researchers used propensity scores and something called an inverse probability of treatment weighting to kind of try to ensure the comparison between the epinephrine first and airway first groups was as fair and balanced as they could possibly make it, considering the myriad of factors at play in each of these cardiac arrest cases. The covariates that they included in their kind of propensity score matching included age, sex, year this occurred, season, weekday or weekend, daytime or nighttime, medical or non-medical cardiac arrest, witnessed or unwitnessed, initial rhythm, bystander CPR, public access to AEDs, dispatcher CPR instructions, pre-hospital physician involvement, interval between call and initiation of CPR by EMS, and the interval between CPR by EMS and the first treatment of epi and advanced airway. So they used a lot of things to try to control these variables, but there's always going to be unknown variables at play.
Yeah, all of that documentation that we're doing all of the time and all the checkboxes that sometimes feel like, what happens to that information? This is what they can do with it. So what I'm hearing you say, Ross, is with the amount of data that's being collected by paramedics, and then also with some really fancy statistics, they're able to do some pretty good analysis. So we shouldn't just write off a retrospective study. We can use this to inform future studies and also aspects of our care. I thought the outcomes they focused on were good outcomes. The primary outcome being 1 month survival, and the secondary outcome being survival with favorable neurological outcome, and also pre-hospital return of spontaneous circulation or ROSC. So sometimes we throw around the word survival, but what we're all really thinking about is, well, was the person ever the same again, or could they be discharged from the hospital? And it sounds like they tried to perform their study in a way that took that into account.
Yeah, exactly. We talk about patient-centered outcomes. So if you're a patient who just received, like just underwent a cardiac arrest, what do you really care about? What you really care about? Do you really care about if you lived and you're on a vent for the rest of your life, or you're in a coma for the rest of your life? Do you care that you got a pulse back until you got to the hospital, but then died in the hospital? No, what you really care about is, did you get a pulse back? Did you get discharged from the hospital 1 month later? And do you still have some sort of quality of life? So yes, a patient-centered outcome that we really care about is survival with good neurologic function. So I agree. Those are the most important outcomes that we kind of care about. And before we go any further, I think it's important for our listeners to know that when we talk about advanced airway management in this context, we're referring to interventions like supraglottic airway or endotracheal intubation.
Yeah. Keep in mind, again, this was Japan, and their paramedic scope of practice is different than the United States. But I think ultimately the care and the order of the interventions is probably going to be very similar, if not the same.
Well, interesting, Will. It actually isn't. And we'll get into this kind of in the conclusions, but there's a difference. And we're going to see here that the vast majority of cases here got advanced airway management first, whereas there was actually a study done in the US and Canada that showed that on average, epi was given 4 minutes faster than advanced airway management in the US and Canada. So there is a difference. We'll talk about why that is. And I think that has to do with the difference in what the providers in Japan are allowed to do.
Yeah. So what did they find?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, in this study, there were almost 260,000 patients included in this analysis after accounting for their kind of exclusion and inclusion criteria. 58.7% of those were male. The median age was 79, and only 8.3% of the patients presented with an initial shockable rhythm. Of the patients that had a shockable rhythm, 28.8% received epi first, compared to 17.4% of patients with non-shockable rhythms who received epi first. So most people in this study, like we just said, received an advanced airway prior to epi administration, which, as I'm thinking about it, maybe makes sense, because if you're taking time to establish an IV, whereas if you're just placing a supraglottic airway or device, you can probably place that supraglottic device faster than you can put an IV in. And as we'll find, the providers in this in Japan are actually not allowed to place IOs. And so none of the patients in this data set had IOs placed or IO epi given. And so maybe that accounts for why most of these got an advanced airway first. And most of the patients in this study received a supraglottic device as opposed to an ET tube. Any thoughts on that?
That's interesting, Ross. I think your point's well taken. What I think I meant to say earlier is, though this study is in Japan, they're still doing things like placing advanced airways, using epinephrine. There's not some outlier intervention that they're doing that's vastly different from any Western systems. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, aside from the lack of IO placements, I think they're using the same medications. They're using the same high quality compressions and training and all of that.
Do you know, did the study talk at all about publicly accessible AEDs or chest compressions by bystanders?
So they certainly controlled for that in some of their covariates for the propensity score matching, and there were some tables based on like how many people received that. But no, I don't think that that's going to be a huge difference compared to the US either. There has been a push recently to adopt a lot of these AEDs. In fact, as I was going through some of the studies surrounding this, there was one, I want to say it was in 2015, I'm not sure, that talked about creating a lot more accessible public access AEDs in Japan. So those were all present as well.
Okay, so 260,000 patients. That's a lot. Just over half are male, so makes sense. And they did some really fancy statistics that I don't fully understand to analyze this data set. After they did all that, where are we? What'd they find?
Yeah, so after performing their analyses, they found that in both the initial shockable rhythm group and the non-shockable group, when epi was administered first, it was administered in a median of 9 minutes compared to a median of 15 minutes for the advanced airway group. Compare this to the timing of advanced airway placement, which they found to be a median of 12 minutes when epi was performed first, and a median of 8 minutes when advanced airway was placed first. And again, this was the same for both initial shockable and non-shockable rhythms. With regards to their primary outcome of survival at 1 month and their secondary outcomes of survival with good functional outcome and just pre-hospital ROSC, they found that in each one of those outcomes, they were more likely to occur in the epi first group than they were in the advanced airway first group. And this held true whether the initial rhythm was shockable or non-shockable, and it held true across all of their statistical analyses.
Interesting. So epi before airway was correlated with good outcome. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. And I love the word you use there, correlated. That's super important because, again, we're talking about a retrospective analysis. And so the people who got epi first, that just happened to correlate with people who had good survival, good neurologic outcomes, and ROSC. But we can't, because it's a retrospective analysis, say that the epi early is actually what caused it, because there could be just unknown variables that we're unable to control for that may have led to confounding that outcome.
And I'm a little taken aback by this first dose of epi at 9 minutes. Do you know, are they talking about from when crews arrived on scene? I guess, what benchmark are they using for starting the clock on that 9 minutes?
Yeah, the benchmark they're using is from EMS initiating CPR. So it is essentially from crews arriving on scene.
You know, I don't have any hard facts in front of me, but I think that that can be shortened significantly. And no, I'm not casting mud at the providers in Japan, but there might be some system improvement possibilities there, because I do feel like it's possible to get that first dose of epi in way sooner than 9 minutes.
Yeah, I agree. It seems like a long time to the first dose of epi, you know, being 9 minutes. But actually, when you look at the study, they cite a study in their discussion of US and Canada, and the median time to epi in our country is actually between 7 to 8 minutes. So it's only 1 to 2 minutes faster.
I feel like there's opportunity for improvement there. I mean, even in just how you stage your equipment. If we're going to hone in on this and potentially think that early epinephrine could impact patients, well, there's a lot of ways to shave seconds off that time.
I agree. It taking that long to get the first dose, like that's 4 cycles of CPR, right? If we're doing 2 minute cycles and changing out providers, doing rhythm checks, that's 4 cycles before you get the first dose. It was surprising to me too. I don't know if maybe giving it early will matter, and we'll talk about that. But I'm not entirely sure what to make of these findings. You know, what I struggle with is the lack of just overall evidence to support that epinephrine actually increases neurologically favorable survival. You know, a recently well done randomized controlled trial compared epi to placebo in cardiac arrest. This was the Paramedic 2 trial. And it found that there was indeed an increase in survival with epi at 1 month compared to placebo. But this difference they found was solely due to the survival of patients with very poor neurological outcomes. Begging the question, is there a fate worse than death? And in another systematic review and meta-analysis that was published in Chest August of last year, entitled Epinephrine in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest by Fernando et al., when they looked at all of the randomized controlled data comparing epi to placebo, they found that epi increases survival to hospital admission, but does not increase survival to hospital discharge or survival with favorable neurologic outcome. Now, the authors in this study, they did cite what was a secondary analysis of that same Paramedic 2 trial. And it showed a trend towards better outcomes the earlier that epi was administered. So maybe earlier epi is better, or just maybe there is some confounding variable or other unknown factor that leads to both early epi and better outcomes, but it wasn't the early epi that caused it. You know, I'll put a link to all of these articles in the show notes, but I'm a little confused by all that.
So Ross, you're a medical director, you're an EMS physician, you're the medical director of a system. Are you changing any protocols based on this?
Here's what I would say. I can't make sense of why epi itself improves outcomes, even if given earlier, based on just kind of the current available randomized controlled trials on epinephrine. So what I would say is that for me, this doesn't emphasize earlier epi. Instead, if I'm taking this all in context, this for me continues to de-emphasize advanced airway management. There are things we know increase survival. That's early CPR, high quality CPR, continuous compressions limiting the time off of the chest, early defibrillation. These are the things that we know increase survival in cardiac arrest. Advanced airway management is just not on that list of things that we know improve survival. Studies have been incredibly inconsistent with regards to airway management, but most of the high quality studies have shown no difference in outcomes between the various strategies. So in my mind, if I'm running a cardiac arrest resuscitation, or if I'm, as a medical director, guiding my paramedics on how to run a resuscitation, airway is one of the last things on my mind. Unless I have a second advanced EMT or paramedic on scene who can just go suck in on the airway while I'm making sure everything else is happening, if I don't have one of those people by my side, on my own, I am merely assigning someone to perform a bag valve mask ventilation while I assure that we have high quality CPR being performed, a defibrillator with pads hooked up, vascular access, a good history of events. And then once I've assured all of these things, all of these basic things that we know actually make a difference in place, then will I consider advanced airway management. But I don't know. What do you think, Will?
Well, don't take away my tube, Ross.
You can have your tube. I'm just saying, just move it.
Come on, man.
Move it back. Make sure that you're doing all of the things that we know actually matter first. And then you can do your tube.
Yeah, I say that tongue in cheek because I know you and I know your feelings on this. And that, you know, if you listen to our last episode on some intubation pearls of wisdom for pre-hospital providers, you specifically say that intubation in cardiac arrest, it has a role and is important. But I think, you know, you're asking my thoughts to back up and put some of this in context, right? I think for a lot of paramedics, especially, well, it really doesn't matter if you're new or you've been doing this a while, you've been taught a way to run a cardiac arrest. And even if that way is only your ACLS class, you're going to see the pendulum swing. You're going to see certain meds be emphasized or de-emphasized. And then it's also important to recognize there's a lot of white noise in cardiac arrest care as well. There are a lot of devices out there that the manufacturers of those devices say it's going to be the next big thing. There are a lot of medication interventions that get told this is going to be the next big thing. For example, when we did steroids and like vasopressin, and I'm not saying that those things don't have a place or that was bad, but I think what we have to do is we have to sift through some of the white noise. And so what I mean by that is certain things have been shown to improve outcome. Certain things are being studied so that we can know if they improve outcome. Because like you said in the very beginning, Ross, this is an important patient population, people that go into cardiac arrest out of hospital, that in the grand scheme of things has a very poor prognosis. And so are there things we can do to benefit them? That is a good question to be asking. I think if you work in a system that is an early adopter of some of these interventions or pieces of equipment that get touted as the next big thing, it can feel a little bit like whiplash because it's like, well, we were told, you know, we have to apply this piece of equipment early in. And, you know, now 3 years later, we're learning like, oh, that doesn't really matter. And, you know, one example that comes to mind quickly is hypothermia, therapeutically induced hypothermia. For a while, that was going to improve neurological outcome. And we were putting refrigerators in ambulances and figuring out how to cool saline. And as someone at the ground level, it's like, I got to change ice packs. And like, oh God, it's 100 degrees outside. I got to bring extra ice packs. And like, and now we don't do it.
So. Yeah. You're absolutely right, Will. And I have a funny story for you. So when I was working on the ambulance, it was still in the days of like, you know, pack the groin, pack the axilla with ice packs after a cardiac arrest when you get ROSC. Then I was sitting in residency as a resident at one of our morbidity mortality conferences talking about a patient who had, you know, hyperthermia for a different reason. And I bring up, you know, I raise my hand and I go, you know, one thing to think about is most ambulances have, you know, these ice packs and you can probably bust those out and pack them in the groin and that'll help cool the patient down. And every paramedic in the room just like glared me down and was like, we don't have ice packs on the ambulance anymore. That was like 5 years ago. We stopped doing that forever ago. So you're absolutely right. And I think that one, it's very hard to study these things in cardiac arrest. There's just so many variables that go into play, not only with regards to running the cardiac arrest, but then after you've gotten ROSC with like post-resuscitation care, there's like innumerable amount of variations that go into post-resuscitation care, which probably make a big outcome difference with regards to, you know, 1 month survival. And so it's a really hard thing to study. But also I think what we found with all of these studies that have just so inconsistent results, we think it helps and then we prove it doesn't help, is that focus on the basics. The basics are going to save lives. We know the basics help. We know that good compressions help. We know that early defibrillation helps. So focus on those things. That's where you're going to have the biggest difference on these patients' lives.
Back to our case, right? So we initially presented this scenario of a cardiac arrest at a bus stop. And ultimately, what I'm really trying to illustrate is you have someone in cardiac arrest in front of you, and you're not an octopus, right? You have 10 tasks you know you want to do. You only have two hands and one partner, and someone's doing chest compressions. So what do you do? And I think about before I was in a critical care capacity, the last system I worked in, Denver Health, we did a lot of solo response duties. So like whether you're working out at the airport or on a bike for a special event, it was possible to roll up to these calls alone. Now, you weren't alone for a long time, but the airport specifically, and you know, this goes for, I think, many public places, they're bystanders doing CPR and they're going to get an AED, which is perfect. So do I bust out my laryngoscope or do I bust out my IO drill or my IV set or what? And honestly, chest compressions, early defibrillation, we know those things matter. Where I think this pushes me, and not just this study, but other ones as well, is vascular access. We need to be thinking very quickly about getting vascular access as fast as possible. Now, it's important to also throw some caveats in there. We also have to be willing and able to critically think and use our brain. The most important tool we bring to any cardiac arrest is what is between our ears. So what do you think, Ross, about a cardiac arrest that is like a primary airway etiology? Let's say we go to a fancy steakhouse for somebody that choked on their T-bone because it was just so good. They inhaled it so fast.
So there's no data on this, right? But I think logically, using the tool that I have between my ears, I think that dealing with that airway sooner rather than later is what's going to fix the problem, because that's what led to the problem, right? So fixing the problem that led to the problem is what you should be focusing on. Whereas the vast majority of cardiac arrests that we're going to see are not going to be airway related. Some are. And if you have a story where it seems very airway related, then sure, yeah, you bump the airway up on your priority list, but the vast majority aren't. And especially that case that you mentioned in the beginning, and it reminds me of a case I had on my own where patient called for chest pain, we're transporting him to the hospital, EKG initially looked fine. I'm sitting in the back of the ambulance with just a paramedic student, and I'm trying to look cool and quiz them on all the various causes of chest pain. And as I ask, so tell me, give me, you know, a differential on 10 different causes of chest pain. Her eyes just go wide as she looks at the patient, who is now agonal respirations, pale, looks like crap. I look over at my monitor and he's in V-fib. And so am I worried about the airway in that? That man was just talking to me. He has some oxygen reserve. I'm not worried about oxygenating that person. I need to fix his heart. And so we immediately lay him down. I have the paramedic students start performing CPR while I get the AED pads out of the monitor. And as soon as I can, I defibrillate him, get back on the chest performing CPR. And next thing I know, he's like trying to pull us off of his chest because he's awake and talking again. So like, you're not worried about the airway. That guy has oxygen reserve. You need to fix the cardiac event that just happened.
100%. So there's a similar study from North America. Do you think this is practice changing stuff ultimately for EMS, or is this hypothesis generating, meaning we're going to be doing more studies on epi and early epi and epi before other things?
Yeah, I think it's hypothesis generating. I mean, you know, they suggest that the earlier the epi, that maybe it might make a difference. And maybe it will. I mean, as we talked about in that North American study, poor Mexico got left out of it. But, you know, in that North American study, we were still waiting until 7 or 8 minutes to give epi. So maybe there is room for improvement there. But again, what I would say is we know the basics matter. And so do that first. Make sure you're doing the basics first, all of that is happening before you move on to these advanced tricks that you have as an ALS provider.
To plug a few things, practice matters. The way you set yourself up matters. When we start studying things like cardiac arrest and the interventions that go into cardiac arrest care, we are sometimes counting seconds. Think about ways in your practice that you can shave seconds off of starting an IV. setting up for an airway, putting an epi together, whatever it is. One thing I like to do, I don't do this every time, but like there's always expired, wasted equipment around. And a lot of times it's in a box for our training folks. Sometimes I just like pull out something that I haven't put my hands on in a while and I put it together. That muscle memory matters. So if you can shave seconds off of what you're doing, it matters. It all adds up. You know, seconds become minutes, as they say, or like ounces become pounds. But it's true. That stuff matters. And I think as we continue to study these things, it's not going to be long before somebody has some whiz-bang fancy thing that can like inject epi straight into your heart through your skin and it costs 10 grand, right? But the bottom line is good IV skills, good IO skills, good muscle memory on where you store your epinephrine in your kit, how to put it together. Don't forget the basics, chest compressions, early defibrillation. Your airway skills matter, having a deliberate approach like we talked about in our last episode. All of these things are the things that when you're on one of these calls and somebody makes it look so effortless, it's usually based on repetition, having done it a bunch, and good practice.
Love it, Will. Dropping wisdom bombs as always. And that practice can be mental practice too, right? Just thinking about it. Viewing that call in your mind and running through each and every one of those steps in your mind can help develop that muscle memory as well.
So Ross, if anybody's curious, what have other studies said? IO versus IV? Well, I mean, does it matter?
Off the cuff, I'm sure there's studies that have talked about this. I don't know them, but I do know that whatever you can get quickly matters. And so one or two attempts at an IV and move on to an IO and you're going to be quicker. And I think that probably accounted for the difference in this study. So as we talked about, the EMTs in Japan aren't allowed to perform IOs. And they talked about this in the discussion where IOs are commonplace in pre-hospital EMS in North America, or at least US and Canada. And so I think you get one, maybe two shots in an IV, and then you got to place an IO because vascular access early might make a difference. Epi early might make a difference.
Cool. So Ross, I'm listening to this while I drive to work my next shift, and I respond to a bus stop and someone drops right in front of me in cardiac arrest, and it's just me and my partner. Should I do anything differently? What are my take-home points?
Focus on the basics. Get on the chest as soon as possible. Perform high quality, continuous CPR, limiting time off of the chest. Get an AED or some sort of defibrillator on as soon as possible, because if they are in VFib or VTAC, early defibrillation matters. Get a good history as to why this happened, because that might tailor your resuscitation. Get IV access. Once you have done these things, consider more advanced procedures like advanced airway management and epinephrine.
Nice, I like it. Is that really so hard?
Lovely.